Welcome to New Letters on the Air. I'm Rebecca Presson. For this edition of our Black History Month celebration, we welcome the poet Nikki Giovanni.
I like Black History Month. I'm glad to be here to celebrate with you. I think that it's significant that we have Black History Month, and I'm hoping that one day we're going to get to the point in the United States that we celebrate everybody's everything. I like a holiday.
Nikki Giovanni is the author of 17 books, among them several volumes of children's poetry and essays. She's a very popular poet. She's been called the Black Princess of Poetry, and she's an accomplished speaker. Giovanni's style is direct, funny, energetic, and opinionated, as you'll hear in this live lecture reading recorded during Black History Month in 1987 at Missouri Western State College in St. Joseph, Missouri.
I was laughing at the Klan recently, and I just think the Klan is not a happy group. But, you know, they probably aren't. But considering how long they've been organized, I think, you know, you're talking 100, maybe 120 years now, they do need to change uniform. I think so, just for the chic of it. You know, I'd like to see, you know, punk it up. They're talking about they don't have any members. Well, who wants to be with these people, this dumb outfit that they've had on all these years? I just think something different ought to happen, is what I'm saying. Because otherwise, we're all going to become crazy. And if those people win, none of us will be happy. Every time the stupid and the haters win, we are all the poorer for it. It's important that we go for it. It is very clear, 1987, that we are in an evolving situation, at least it's clear to me. And one of the things that I like about being on planet Earth right now, one of the things that I think is great about being on planet Earth, is that we are totally in communication. I think that's fantastic, because that eliminates ignorance. That eliminates the possibility of us not knowing who we are. We can pick up our turn on our television sets, and we can see images from any place on this planet, but more. For those of you who are young and who care about this sort of thing, you can look forward to getting off of this planet. It is really exciting to me that the Russians right now are having cosmonauts in space that they expect to stay up there 2 months. That's a space station. That is the first effective space station. That's exactly what's happening. I don't believe that there is no life in space. I happen to be a space nut. I do know, and I would say this any time and any place, I do know that we need to send a black woman into space because the people that we have been sending into space haven't seen life on Earth. You send a bunch of scientists and, a group of white boys who do not understand life here, how do we expect them to recognize life in another form? I like Sally Ride. I don't have a problem with Miss Ride. But I do know, I like Buford too, who is a black guy. I do know that if we could send ourselves a 40 or 50-year-old black woman who would have a minute to sit and look around, if there would be life, she would find it. And I base that just on such basic things as if that is the same woman who would take rotten peaches and make a cobbler. That's the same woman that could take leftover scraps and make a quilt and have one of the most beautiful things on earth. If that woman could come back and tell me that there's no life in space, I'll believe it, but I don't think she will. I think she'll say, I'm seeing something different, and I like that. Because we know one thing about human beings, we are a fragile species. It worries you sometimes when you realize how absolutely nuts we are, how anything will upset our equilibrium. That's true, we are frightened. We are a very nervous group of people. But every time there is a crisis, we come through. Every time there is a tragedy, we come through. If a tornado comes through here in the morning, there will be no black and white in St. Joe. There will be no men and women in St. Joe. We won't have to worry about equal pay for equal work, because the men and the women and the blacks and the whites and the children and everybody else will start to rebuild the community. I simply submit, why do we always have to wait on a tragedy? And one of the things we as people do is always wait until it becomes impossible. It's like men and women. He will beat you and beat you and beat you. When you finally say you're leaving, he says, I'm sorry, honey. I didn't know it hurt. Well, yes, you did. Sure you did, and it's stupid to approach it that way. Why do we always have to hurt each other before we can get to the point of saying, well, since we're here, this is a small planet. It is a tiny and a fragile ecosystem. We should be careful of the air we're breathing. We're not breathing air because we're bored. We're breathing air because it lets us live. And yet we can have, now you probably don't have the problem that we're having all over it with the acid rain. We're polluting the air, and everybody wants to say no smoking. I love a no smoking sign. You would think cigarettes had done this. Cigarettes are killing the fish or something. We have a real problem with the ecosystem that we're living in. We have a problem with nuclear waste. I love a nuclear waste because there's never going to be, you can bet, there will never be a nuclear war. We're going to leak ourselves to death, slowly but surely, and very, very tacky. I hate tacky. Don't you hate? I mean, you would just love the explosion. Well, okay, we blew each other up. It's not going to get to that. It's going to get to a little pool glowing here and a little pool glowing there, and we have headaches and nobody knows why, and everybody says, you know, it's that time of month for you, or some crap. And, no, it drives you nuts. It drives you nuts. I think it's nice to be alive. I do recommend it. I really do. If you're not busy, try living. Sometime between your birth and your death, there ought to be something called your life. And I think it would be such a waste for those of us who are young, particularly. I think it would be such a waste if you spend all of your life being an observer of it. You must participate in it. It's nice to be a Midwesterner. I live in the Midwest. I like Ohio. I recommend us. If you're not busy, come out and live with us. But I know you got to get out of Missouri and Kansas and Ohio and the United States and all the rest of it, because you grow up here and you begin to think this is the real world. You begin to think that everybody should be a part of what you're doing, that everybody thinks like you. I remember the big shock in my life, the first time I went to Africa, was that you couldn't get milk. You know, it was one of those things, it's like, it kept bothering me and bothering me. And finally, it dawned on me what bothered me. What did the kids do for bottled milk? They said, we don't do bottled milk. How can you not do bottled milk? I mean, you grow up in America, they tell you don't drink your milk, you're going to die in the morning. You know, it's amazing. I'm just trying to suggest that you do something else. Because wherever you're from, it's going to be there. Whatever state you're from, whatever city you're from, whatever area you're from, it's going to be there. If you go and do something, if you like it, you might stay. If you don't, you might come back. There will always be someone who, if you come back, will say, I knew you couldn't make it. Because there's always a fool sitting around trying to depress you. That's true. One of the important things in life is to identify a fool as quickly as possible so that you can get rid of them. Otherwise, you'll be trying to live up to this standard, which you'll find it is not a live up to, it's a live down to. And it will be depressing you and upsetting you, and you will say to yourself, why am I not happy? You're not happy because you got a fool in your life. Get rid of him. Find somebody to love. If you're looking for somebody to care about, somebody's going to take advantage of that, because people seem to take advantage of it. This is whether you're a man or whether you're a woman. Somebody will take advantage of you. Somebody will misuse you. Don't let that become the norm. Do something that makes you happy. Find a friend. Find someone you love. Do something for yourself. It's good to sacrifice and help the people. I like the people. I'm one of us. But I think that that can be overblown, too. You can look around and you've put so much of your life into everybody else, you don't have a life. I'm going to start with a poem. This is the only poem that I'm going to read, honestly, that I'm going to ask you to like. The rest of them, if you don't like it, I understand. I like this poem a lot, and I was always taught, my grandmother was named Lavinia Watson, and my grandmother taught me, if you want something, you must ask for it. That makes sense to me. And since I want you to like this, I'm asking you to. Now, if you really don't sort of like it, it's all right, because good manners should prevail. See, some things in life are not about how you really feel. My son and I argue about this one, too. Because they say, well, I really don't care, I really don't want to ask so-and-so. And I say, that's not the point. The answer to things like, how do you feel, is fine. When you wake up in the morning, you say good morning, no matter what happened. You know, some things just sort of go along. And since I know poetry audiences are quite polite, I'm going to ask you to like this poem. I will then not ask you, did you really mean it? There's nothing worse than somebody being polite and somebody else saying, but is that actually how you feel? I won't do that. You will pretend you like it, and I will pretend that you do, and then we'll all be happy, and I'll tell my mother I read my poem in St. Joe, and they liked it. And she'll say, did they really? And I'll say, I didn't know, Mother, I didn't ask. I'm a great naval contemplator, in fact. I think probably most writers are. And one of the things that I did at 40, I like my 40s, by the way, and if any of you are not yet 40, I recommend them. They are lots of fun. It's really nice because your kid is going to graduate soon. You know, I mean, just a lot of things sort of get in shape, and you probably can think about the next couple of years getting a car or something. One of the things that I did was I asked myself at 40, if I could do anything, what would I do? Or if I could do it again. You figure at 40, by the way, I'm sure you did. You figure like when you turn 30 that you'll get another 30. That's really easy. I mean, most people make it to 60, all things being equal. But when you turn 40, you don't necessarily think you have another 40 to go. A lot of people do make it to 80, but it's You may or you may not, or you may make it and it may not be what you think or something. So I wanted to sit down, and I wanted to ask myself, if I could do anything that I wanted, what would I do? And I realized I would do what I do. I do like my profession. I like writing. I like traveling. I like where I am. And I wanted to write a poem to sort of just deal with who I think I am when I think that things are going well. It's a poem called I Am She. I am she, making rainbows in coffee cups, watching fish jump after midnight in my dreams. On the stove, left front burner, is the stew already chewed, certain to burn as I dream of waves of nothingness. Floating to shore, riding a low moon on a slow cloud, I am she who writes the poems. I really do like that poem. I hope you meant it. I really do. It's full of symbolism. I don't write many poems that are full of symbolism. If any of us are readers of my poetry, I like to be clear. I like to just like go straight forward and say this is what I'm gonna say. That's full of symbolism, so I like it. My father was I'm sharing adult thoughts on him, but was a very clever man. He had us totally convinced that we were obviously superior to everybody. He would complain about friends that had indoor toilet. I don't know why they do that, he would say. And my sister and I would grow up thinking, well, why do you have a toilet inside like that? I mean, good Lord. Totally depressed the neighborhood, you know. I think he was right, because if he had not taught us to do that, we probably would have been totally depressed. We used to go, we had a 53 Chevrolet, it was green, and we used to go out riding on Sundays. I don't know if people would still do things like that. And we would go out to the better neighborhoods. And he would say, you know, you go out to Amber, well, this place you wouldn't know, but Amberley Village or to Indian Hill. And he would say, you see, everybody's doing the same thing. And he was right, of course. The poor neighborhoods didn't have sidewalks, but neither did the rich neighborhoods. The poor neighborhoods didn't have fences, but neither did the rich neighborhoods. So the only difference between the rich and the poor was the size of the house. And as he said, what you gonna do with all that? You can't even heat it. It made sense. And to this day, nothing would get me to live in a big house, and that's the truth. My idea of ideal would be one big room, you know. And it's kind of amazing what parents do, because I feel sorry in many, many respects for young black youngsters today who will tell you, I grew up in a ghetto. We never, ever thought of where we were as a ghetto. We thought of it as our neighborhood. We thought of it as our home. You would never, ever have heard me or any of my peers say that we were poor. I was grown before I finally realized that people did, in fact, have things and enjoy them that we never did. And it was an amazing kind of thing, because I realized, too, I don't miss it. I'm not sorry for my son. I wouldn't relive those days. I know also it had to be quite difficult on both of my parents. I do applaud them that they stayed together and that they worked hard and worked it through. They sent two daughters to college, and for whatever sanity I might possess, I would credit them with it. The insanity is mine alone. I hate a whiner. I hate people that say, yeah, well, if I had just had a doll when I was growing up. No, you're a fool, man, and nothing is going to change that. I wrote a poem because I wanted my father to know, while he was still well, he did die a couple of years ago, he had cancer, but I wanted him to know that I thought he did a good job. I will say this for any of us who are grown men here, do not work all the time. One of the things that happens to you guys is that you get married and you have to do it. You have to do two or three jobs. Then you drop one, then you end up doing two. And what you're on is such a treadmill that it never occurs to you that you should retire. Your kids are grown. The dog is old. Retire and enjoy your wife. What you are is afraid you won't have anything to talk about. And my dad worked until he had a stroke. They took him off the job, and that was a shame. I mean, my sister, we could not convince him to retire. And I would say for any of you who are men, who think that all you do in life is work, it's good to work, yes, but it's good also to stop it for a while and do something with your family. Let them know who you are so that you're not a stranger to them, so that you're not just a figure. I wrote a poem for my parents because I think that they did a good job, and I thought that somebody should applaud people like my parents. Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, they never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself. and how good the water felt when you got your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow, when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings as the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together. And you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me, because they never understand black love is black wealth. And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while, I was quite happy.
Nikki Giovanni has won a host of awards, many of which are not typical for a poet. She's been given 6 honorary doctorates from various colleges and universities and been given keys to the city in 13 places, including, of course, her much-loved hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio. Giovanni's also been honored as Woman of the Year by Mademoiselle and Ladies Home Journal magazines and by the YWCA in Cincinnati. As New Letters on the Air continues, we'll hear more of the poetry of Nikki Giovanni.
I know my upper arms will grow flabby. It's true of all the women in my family. I know that the purple veins, like dead fish in the sand, will dot my legs one day. And my hands will wither while my hair turns grayish-white. I know that. One day my teeth will move when my lips smile, and a flutter of hair will appear below my nose. I hope my skin doesn't change to those blotchy colors. I want my menses to be undifficult. I'd very much prefer staying firm and slim to grow old, like a vintage wine fermenting in old wooden vats with style. I'd like to be exquisite, I think. I will look forward to grandchildren and my flowers, all my knickknacks in their places, and that quiet of the bombs not falling in Cambodia, settling over my sagging breast. I hope my shoulder finds a head that needs nestling, and my feet find a footstool after a good soaking with Epsom salts. I hope I die warmed by the life that I try to live. I used to take my nephew. I saw somebody has it. I'm going to read the title poem from the book Cotton Candy on a Rainy Day. My sister has a son. We are 2 girls, and we each have 1 boy. And Christopher was the first baby in the family. My son is 10 years younger than Chris. And I used to take Christopher to the zoo because I like the zoo. I don't know if any of us are zoo freaks, but you're really close to Omaha, and Omaha has a really, really swell zoo. But I like the zoo all year round. I like the zoo in the winter, and I like the zoo in the summer because you get to see different things. And I used to just go and pick up Chris and say, let's go to the zoo. Well, I liked cotton candy. Now, I do think that my age is showing on this one, because I think now when you do cotton candy, they bring it to you in this big bag and it's rubbery crap. But when I was growing up, they took the sugar and they put it in the machine and it went around, right? And cotton candy cost you a quarter. Now, the problem was they would not sell cotton candy on a cloudy day because it's very fragile and it would melt, okay? So we went to the zoo one day, and it was a cloudy day. Chris had his little yellow thing on, and it was like it might or might not rain, but I like the animals in the rain. We stopped because both of us like cotton candy. I said, hey, let's get some cotton candy, right? And we go over to the cotton candy lady, and she says, you want some Cracker Jacks? No, I don't want Cracker. I hate Cracker Jacks, as a matter of fact. I don't say I can eat that crap. It gets, never mind. But for those of you who love Cracker Jacks. But I said, no, I said, we'd like some cotton candy. She says, we're not fixing cotton candy today. And I said, why? You know, it was just one of those, like, well, why not? You know, she says, because it'll melt. And I said, whoa, because this is one of those things, like, wait a minute. Okay, at that point, a quarter was a credible amount of money. This is my quarter. I am willing to pay it for the cotton candy. If it melts, is that really your business? I mean, that's a little more self, you know, protective of me than I wished for her to become. Well, she says, we just don't do it. I said, this is crazy. I got, you know, my nephew and I want cotton. I mean, it was foolish, because she was not, because as she said, it will melt. Well, I thought about it. It stuck with me a long time because, it sticks with me today. Even Chris has grown. But it's one of those things, then should I not look at a sunset? When the sun is going down, should I avoid it? Should I close my eyes because it won't last? Should I never fall in love? Because what if it doesn't work after a couple of weeks or a couple of years or a couple of decades or a couple of whatever? What are you supposed to do? Should I never eat a great meal? Because after all, it's only going to be there once. I should never drink a great bottle of wine. I should do something cheap and ugly because it can stand up. I mean, I wish I knew that. It still ticks me off because people think like that. People think that because it can't last, it shouldn't be. But there's nothing beautiful that lasts. Anything that would be beautiful that would last would become ordinary, and then we would look for something else. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. It just ticked me off, but it stayed with me for the longest. And when I was working on that book, which is a very introspective book, one of the things that I realized, the concepts that I was dealing with, was that that's what life is. It is simply cotton candy on a rainy day. And nobody wants to share it because, after all, it might melt. I wrote a poem. Don't look now, I'm fading away into the gray of my mornings or the blues of every night. Is it that my nails keep breaking, or maybe the corn on my second little piggy? Things keep popping out on my face or of my life. It seems no matter how I try, I become more difficult to hold. I am not an easy woman to want. They have asked the psychiatrists, psychologists, politicians, and social workers what this decade will be known for. There is no doubt it is loneliness. If loneliness were a grape, the wine would be vintage. If it were a wood, the furniture would be mahogany. But since it is life, it is cotton candy on a rainy day, the sweet, soft essence of possibility, never quite maturing. I have prided myself on being in that great tradition, albeit circus, that the show must go on, though in my community the vernacular is one monkey, don't stop the show. We all line up at some midway point to thread our way through the boredom and futility, looking for the blue ribbon and gold medal, mostly. These are seen as food labels. We are consumed by people who sing the same old song, Stay, As Sweet As You Are, In My Corner, or perhaps just a little bit longer. But whatever you do, don't change. Baby, baby, don't change. Well, something needs to change. Everything, some say, will change. I need a change of pace, face, attitude, and life, though I long for my loneliness. I know I need something or someone, or I strangle my words as easily as I do my tears. I stifle my screams as frequently as I flash my smile. It means nothing. I am cotton candy on a rainy day, the unrealized dream of an idea unborn. I share with the painters the desire to put a three-dimensional picture on a one-dimensional surface. I have a children's poem. This is a poem called Winter. Frogs burrow the mud, snails bury themselves, and I air my quilts, preparing for the cold. Dogs grow more hair, mothers make oatmeal, and little boys and girls take Father John's medicine. Bears store fat, chipmunks gather nuts, and I collect books for the coming winter. Some kids say, why do you collect books? So that's what I do. I love books. So reading is not only fundamental, it's fun. And if any of us in here are young or even old or whatever we are, you got to read. You just got to read. It's so important. And I hope you have a library card because libraries are nice. Librarians are your friends. And I think some of the nicest people on earth are librarians. They really are underpaid, underappreciated. And I think it's really crap the way we treat librarians. Like, oh, anybody can do that. And if you've ever had a stupid librarian, you immediately begin to appreciate the really good ones. And most of them are very, very good. You know, you go in and you say, oh, I want to read a book. Well, what would you like to read, dear? Oh, I don't know. I just finished reading. And they read themselves. And I think that's to be commended. I mean, on that alone, I think the librarian should make the same thing as any other policeman. I do. They're dealing with ideas, and ideas we all concede are dangerous, right? So the difference between a librarian and a cop is that a cop has a human being who's dangerous. She has books that are dangerous. Why shouldn't she be paid the same thing? Because the key to that is she, isn't it? When men become librarians in big numbers, the price will go up, but that's another discussion. That is another discussion. I'm going to read a couple of love poems. Once, a snowflake fell on my brow, and I loved it so much. And I kissed it, and it was happy, and called its cousins and brothers. And a web of snow engulfed me then. I reached to love them all, and I squeezed them. And they became a spring rain. And I stood perfectly still and was a flower. I only want to be there to kiss you as you want to be kissed when you need to be kissed, where I want to kiss you because it's my house and I plan to live in it. I really need to hug you when I want to hug you as you like to hug me. Does this sound like a silly poem? I mean, it's my house and I want to fry pork chops and bake sweet potatoes and call them yams because I run the kitchen and I can stand the heat. I spent all winter in carpet stores gathering patches so I could make a quilt. Does this really sound like a silly poem? I mean, I want to keep you warm. And my windows might be dirty, but it's my house. And if I can't see out sometimes, they can't see in either. English isn't a good language to express emotion through. Mostly, I imagine, because people try to speak English instead of trying to speak through it. I don't know. Maybe this is a silly poem. I'm saying it's my house. And I'll make fudge and call it love and touch my lips to the chocolate warmth and smile at old men and call that revolution, because what's real is really real. And I still like men in tight pants, because everybody has something to give, and more important, needs something to take. And this is my house, and you make me happy, so this is your poem.
Nikki Giovanni's latest volume of poems is titled Sacred Cows and Other Edibles. It is published by William Morrow. Giovanni was recorded by Trish Reeves at Missouri Western State College in St. Joseph, Missouri. Cassette copies of this program are available. To receive one, send a check for $7.50 to New Letters on the Air, in care of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Once again, that's New Letters on the Air, in care of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine and KCUR-FM. It was founded by David and Judy Ray. This edition was produced with assistance from Ron Jones, Kevin Danner, and Carla Fish. Gerald Kemner wrote our theme, and some of our financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Rebecca Presson. She's been called the Black Princess of Poetry. Nikki Giovanni's style is direct, funny, energetic, and highly opinionated. On the next New Letters on the Air, hear Nikki Giovanni as she speaks her mind and reads her poems, as New Letters on the Air celebrates Black History Month on this public radio station.